This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. They say all politics is local, but events happening on the world stage can have a very real effect on individual investment portfolios. Peter Sorrentino, Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager with Huntington Funds, and Financial Advisor Chris DeSimio will shed some light on the impact developments in the U.S. and overseas are having on the current investment outlook. And you can join our discussion at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, Chris, today's data looked pretty good. The ADP reported 191,000 new jobs last month. Factory orders up, what, 1.6%?
They were strong. We've had a lot of strong data.
Biggest increase since September. So I wonder, is this a sign that the economy is turning a corner?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that Pete is here, because we were going to ask Pete. Pete, are we in an environment now where good news is actually good news, or should we be afraid of good news such as what Mark just described?
No, actually, I would say that what we want to see is a continuation of these numbers, and the strong employment growth is important, because what we saw so far in this recovery has really been a very, very tame labor market. And one of the things that's missing in terms of driving it has been growth in disposable income. Consumers, especially last year, really levered themselves back up again. And that's one of our concerns perennially is how are we funding our growth? And right now, we're a little concerned, and we've seen it in the stock market. You've seen the consumer sector is underperforming so far this year. And that, I think, is sort of telltale to what we saw last year. So to see a consistent recovery in the employment growth, to see the participation rate rise, those are critical, I think, in terms of sustaining this recovery, because it's running into some headwinds right now.
Yeah, you have frequently commented about how you have to look at those employment numbers, and the bar has been set higher. Apparently, the weather in March wasn't great, but it wasn't as bad as January and February. So they're expecting a lot. I think the number is the consensus estimate is about 195,000 for non-farm payroll. But you have talked about the difference between that number and the overall unemployment rate, and then the so-called U6. Explain what U6 is and why it's a big deal.
U6, when you go to the Department of Labor's website, and you drill down into the report, it's actually the bottom number at the end of the report. And what it shows you is the true rate of employment and unemployment in the country. It includes everyone who is physically capable of holding a job. Because what happens in the top line number is oftentimes if you've been unemployed long enough, you fall off the count. But in the U6 number at the very bottom, they include all those people back. And so what we saw for an extended period of time in the recovery was that number had locked in the mid-teens and didn't move for month after month after month.
Is it starting to move now?
That's been one of the big changes in the last 12 months is we've actually seen that number begin to move downward. And that is a very encouraging sign for the economy's health overall.
Now, Chris DeSimio knows this is my favorite number, the VIX, which measures the level of anxiety, so they say. And right now, I think it's around 13 last I checked.
I thought your favorite number, Mark, was UD Flyers Elite 8.
Oh, well.
I thought that was your favorite number.
Outside of the financial world.
Okay.
But VIX, relatively low. S&P, I think, just reached a new high today. The market seems pretty unflappable right now. Is this a sense of false security on my part, or is this real?
Actually, it's been one of the things that concerns us is that the level of volatility, as you pointed out, has been scraping along at a fairly low level for most of this recovery. We've not seen any sustained spikes. We've had spikes in the past that have been caused by upheavals. But in terms of overall, the VIX has been at a very low level. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because that was one of the things that we've seen in the press in the last couple of days, a discussion about Mike Lewis's book and about how the market is rigged by high velocity trading. Well, the very low VIX level is actually a beneficial outgrowth of that, because you've got so much money. Any anomalies in the market are very quickly sort of bludgeoned out by the arbitrage and the fact that you've got all this money moving it literally at light speed. It keeps volatility at a relatively low level. And so the individual investor has been benefiting, even though I think Mr. Lewis's book would paint it as they have been disadvantaged by it. I think if you looked another, kind of a step beyond that, they've actually been the closet beneficiaries of all this.
Yeah, just to put that in perspective, I have a chart that goes back 5 years. I mean, so it doesn't capture what the VIX did, the so-called the volatility index. The ticker is just VIX, the fear index. It's
the something. Blood pressure of the stock market.
Exactly. That's a good way to look at it. That number lately got as high in the last few years as in the 40s. It hit 40 back in 2010 when the flash crash happened, hit 40 again as Congress was arguing about in 2011 when the Dow and S&P fell nearly 20%. From this through the summer 2011, and then it also there was a spike then. But since then, it had a little mini spike in 2012 at about 28, a little mini spike at the end of 2012 at about 24. But it's been below 20 for a long time, and now stands at 13. It has been. So how does this then jive with people who are afraid that or concerned that all this high speed trading or any kind of trading is somehow increasing volatility?
It's interesting. I think the fear is that somebody gets it wrong. And
hits the wrong button,
and I think that's the flash crash, and I think that was I think that's if you want to see a sort of prima facie evidence that sometimes if these guys get it wrong, they can hurt the market in general. But given the volume at which this money's flowing and the sophistication of the algorithms they're using, it's almost self-correcting. Now, again, every time we create some new financial instrument, a la portfolio insurance in 87 or derivatives in 94, it's just a matter of time before somebody in the lab, tweaks it just a bit too hard and it goes bad on us. But I think the important thing is it's been brought to light. But volatility is a cyclical feature in the marketplace, and it usually swings from one extreme to another. And we've been at this low level for what I would consider an extended period of time, although in the last 20 years we've had these where the market has traded at levels above where it should have for an extended period, below where it should have for an extended period. I think volatility is the same in the same vein. We're going to see it swing back at some point in time. My guess is that if the regulators go after these this particular element of the trading universe, you'll see money drain out of that, and the law of unintended consequence, what we'll get back will be sort of the rebirth of normalized volatility. And so instead of trading in the teens, we'll be back at that 40 level at some point in the near future.
And going back to what Michael Lewis said in the 60 Minutes interview, I don't think at least personally, I wasn't really surprised by it because I've kind of always intuitively known that this kind of thing existed in this day and age in the stock market. So it really what he said wasn't breaking news or a huge surprise to me. I've always just kind of taken that into account.
If you looked at the volatility, or not the volatility, but the volume that on the exchanges on a daily basis, and look at the overall capitalization, it's churning on itself. If you look at the daily trading in some of the exchange traded funds, there's an arbitrage you can have between, say, two funds that are invested in, say, emerging markets. They know what the underlying portfolios are, and you see huge flows in between. They're not creating any new units. It's simply the same guys flipping those funds over and over again, picking up a half penny arbitrage. So, I mean, the footprints have been in the sand for a long time in this area. I just think it's interesting that now all of a sudden someone turned the light on and the cockroaches are scrambling. They've been there all along.
Well, ultimately, I think I really agree with the folks who say that the way to deal with this is to go back to looking at fundamentals, invest in companies that have a good record and good growth potential, and then just hang in there for the long term. Then you don't have to worry about a few pennies and a few milliseconds.
Yeah, you never hear Warren Buffett complaining about high volume trading. If you're owning a business, if you're investing in a business, that's just – it's entertainment on a day-to-day basis. The price matters at two points, when you bought it and when you sell it. And besides that, the rest of it, again, is just purely for entertainment value.
Yeah. It's hard to believe that the first quarter has come to an end and that over that three-month period that the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.72 for the quarter. NASDAQ was up just a shade over half a point. And the S&P 500 was up 1.3. But within those somewhat broader indices, of course, the Dow is only 30 companies. If you look at the sectors, there's a broad divergence. And it's kind of surprising because a lot of people had written the utility sector off, completely off, that this is moribund. There's nothing happening here. That was the leading sector of the market last quarter, up over 9%. How'd that happen, Pete?
I think we've had such a muted economic cycle that we're coming out, as I said, last year was probably the last year that the consumer stocks will do as well as they did for a while because the fundamentals are, in our view, are turning against them. But if you look at the renaissance in manufacturing, in basic materials in the U.S. because of cheap natural gas, I mean, it really comes down to that. You're seeing a huge build out in all the energy infrastructure and natural gas and its benefit for utility companies. you know, you're now seeing a pickup because people are anticipating higher industrial output, and therefore utilities would be the first beneficiary. So yeah. it's like a restart to the cycle.
Yeah, and
again.
It's surprising because the industrial sector was one of a few which ended the quarter in the red. Surprisingly, not much. The industrials as a sector down about 0.3, down about 0.4%. But it's just surprising. This plus the bond market, which everyone also had thought was just completely dead money, the bond market had a pretty reasonable quarter. What did you expect to have happen in the next quarter, and to what effect do you think the Fed's latest statement might influence that?
Yeah, when we look at you brought up the industrials and the Dow, and what's interesting that the characteristic that they both share is they're exposed to the emerging markets, those fast developing markets, and commodity prices really completed last year a collapse. It really began the year before, and we saw it finally manifest out as concerns about what the real growth rate in China was. So if you're a multinational, which tend to be a lot in the Dow, or you're an industrial like Caterpillar or Dover, someone like that who's exposed to those markets, the fact that commodities have sold off means that those economies are going to slow, and so your business is going to slow. If you look at a lot of the domestic manufacturers and those that are focused more in North America, they've actually done quite well. Again, they're participating in this sort of renaissance in North America. So our view is that that is going to continue, and that really the agricultural sector in the U.S. is going to become the new sort of tech bubble, if you will, that ag in North America is now an export industry.
Now, there are bubbles out there in the cattle and out there in the cow pastures, but they're different kinds of
was
bubbles.
Was it the Dutch tulip bulb bubble and things like that? So is the idea, are we too focused on stocks perhaps, in particular the Dow? Is the idea of allocating your assets still valid?
It really is. And that's, I think, one of the things that the last 10 years has taught us, that we thought that if you diversify between stocks and bonds, or you diversified between different types of companies, that you'd protected yourself. And as we saw in 2008, 2009, it was no safe haven. Everybody got taken out to the woodshed at the same time. To really extend beyond that into other asset classes, I think is critical at this point in time, especially if you're looking at retirement and generating income. You have to look at things such as owning interest in businesses that generate regular income streams, whether it's master limited partnerships for energy pipelines or real estate investment trusts where you actually own income-producing property, or even owning those properties outright. There are a number of ways that you can own them directly. And by spreading out, to what's your investment horizon, I think going forward is the only way you're going to be able to protect yourself and to sort of stabilize your accumulated wealth.
Speaking of real estate investment trust, over the weekend, Barron's, the latest issue that has a picture of a barrel of oil at $75 and why that's bad for Vladimir Putin, did a special on real estate investment trusts, REITs, that specialize in, of all things, retail properties, retail sales. Do you think the consumer is still going to bail out the bricks and mortar retailers, or have they? Is that just a thing of the past now, having been left in the dust by e-commerce?
I think each year when we look at the results from the holiday season, and you see just every year it's an ever increasing percentage of the spending is taking place over the internet. Physical retail space, I think, will always have a place. The problem is that you've got this sort of evolution from what we had built that worked well in the 50s and 60s, and we lived with the legacy of that in the 70s and 80s, to moving to a different model now, whether it's outdoor malls, neighborhood centers. It really is beginning to shift. You talked earlier in this hour about the move to urban living away from the suburbs and the urban professional. Well, that creates a whole different retail opportunity where you go back and redevelop an existing structure. So it will change. I don't think the dynamic that drove us in the past will drive us going forward. I think we're way overbuilt in retail space. But the last buggy whip maker in town still gets a couple of bucks before he eventually goes out of business.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us in our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we got a question from Eric. He says, if the Fed's quantitative easing is such a good thing, why don't they keep it a constant policy? And he's questioning, does QE have a downside?
unfortunately, I think it does, and we're beginning to see that manifest itself. Everyone's doing the same thing right now.
Europe, for example.
Europe, the Japanese.
Abenomics.
And so what you do is you're simply exporting your problem to the emerging markets of the world. And the downside of that is you collapse their economies. Well, if their economies collapse, your growth markets now collapse. And so the circle comes full on you. And so in a currency war, no one wins. It's a race to the bottom. And if you borrow more than you produce, as we have for almost a decade now, at some point your currency becomes suspect and it loses its value. And we've begun to see that in this recent episode in Ukraine is a great example of that. Russia is now looking to ink a deal to export energy directly to China. And they're not looking to denominate that in dollars. They're looking to do that in renminbi and probably even gold. And so as a result, the dollar is at risk of losing its premier status as sort of the world reserve currency. Most all commodity trades up to this point in time have been settled in dollars. So if that begins to change, that puts us at a disadvantage because then that flood of dollars we've been printing over the last 5 years is going to come home to roost. Basic supply and demand hasn't been repealed, and if you print too much of something, it falls in value.
My perception, Crimea just hasn't had much of an effect on in particular, the U.S. stock market. And is that an accurate assessment?
It actually hasn't had – I was looking over the numbers. It really hasn't bothered even the European markets.
Which is surprising. Is that surprising to you?
That's very surprising.
Yeah. Tanks are on the move. Troops are marching and – nobody really terribly concerned about it. It makes, I guess, some in power worried, but it doesn't seem to have influenced the financial markets in any significant way.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are exchange-traded single-country funds now that invest in essentially the S&P 500 versions of of Poland, and there's a single country funds for some of these Eastern European markets, and they did flinch a little bit, maybe down about 3 or 4%, but they came rip-roaring right back too. How is it then that something – is that the market saying that essentially this was built into the price, that this is not a big surprise that Russia invades Crimea? Is that what the financial markets are really saying?
I think to some extent, but it didn't get a lot of press at the time. Although if you look at what happened in the commodity markets, it was very clear what was being done. The president announced that they were going to do a test sale from the strategic petroleum reservoir. And that sent the energy markets just trembling, because what that was effectively was the U.S. government saying, all right, Russia, if you don't behave yourself, we'll open the taps. We'll flood the oil market. And we know your budget's built on $75 barrel oil. We'll drive it to that price and watch what happens to you.
Kind of like doing military exercises, only this case are economic exercises.
Used to be we could count on the Saudis to help us with that. But I think the Saudis this time said, look, this is a European problem. We'll sit this one out. But, I think the U.S. stepped in and said, look, we could pump, enough oil for a couple of years. And basically, we think we can outlast you on this one. So that seemed to calm everyone down after that announcement was made that, we'll pull the oil weapon and we'll go after your budget.
When it comes down to it, the global events, no doubt they have an effect on the market, but ultimately it seems like what happens, Peter, is that investors always come back to what's happening close to home.
Absolutely true. At the end of the day, what matters is that which is, closest to us. People, like to think globally, but they're going to act locally. And, the results of Procter & Gamble, Armco Steel, those are going to weigh a lot more on sort of the investment psyche than really what goes on in terms of, events in the Ukraine or events in Iran or, any place around the globe.
Or even what the Federal Reserve might be up to has a lot of impact, it seems like. Do we still have low interest rates as far out as we can see? Do we know where Janet Yellen is heading with all this?
Given that she's one of the authors of the zero interest rate policy that we've been through the last couple of years, I don't suspect we're going to see a major change. Hopefully, her initial comments are a lot more transparent than her predecessors, and I think that makes the market a little more comfortable. And I think the taper will continue, and as long as the economy and the employment numbers hold together. We did get a bump in interest rates last year, though, and that's people don't think about it. We went from 3% mortgages to 4% mortgages. Doesn't sound like much, but on a percentage basis, it was enough to really start to slow housing down. So As far as bubbles go, the only one she's got going right now is in stock prices.
Do you think her initial transparency came as a shock to the stock market? Because I know that the day she gave her comments, it really roiled things a little
bit. Well, yeah, we were almost flat as the minutes were read, and then it was the press conference after where she let the cat out of the bag, so to speak, and it was almost like, gee, was it something I said? We were down over 200 points. We went from being – were you surprised by anything that she said?
I was surprised. Her candor was actually striking in that you normally, especially when you look at the past two chairmen, they've mastered the art of fog speak and
fogification.
And her comment, you just look at what's happened to the leadership in the market ever since that press conference. Financial service stocks, banks in particular, have just been off to the races.
Exactly,
because now they're spread. Now they're going to be able to make something on loans, and and so as a result, investors are almost giddy about bank stocks now.
Amazing.
Let's talk to Jerry in Kenwood. Good afternoon, Jerry.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and question.
Okay, go right ahead.
Comment is that I just like to say that Chris DeSimeo is a consummate professional.
Oh.
And does a great job.
I was a little worried at first there, Jerry.
Question is, how do you determine at any given time whether the equity market is overvalued, undervalued, or fair valued for investment purposes?
Good question, Jerry. Thank you very much.
Peter, I'm going to let you tackle that. it's
a broad question.
When you say the word fair value, I mean that's something that's every day. Fair value, that has to do with the futures prices and that sort of thing. But then you look at just valuations. Is price earnings ratio still the most common metric? And can you use it in an absolute way, or do you always still need to look at the price of a dollar of a company's earnings in relation to the alternatives, namely interest rates?
I think, Chris, you touched on it. I think there are some things that repeat in terms of companies' valuation. At the very bottom, basic industry stocks always look expensive. The PEs are always high because the E is so low. So you want to kind of be mindful of where you are in the cycle. But again, your point about alternatives, what are interest rates? Because that's the discounting factor for those future earnings. So if you think interest rates are going to be climbing, you want to make sure that earnings are going to at least be able to keep pace. Otherwise, you've got an asset that just by simple math is going to devalue itself.
So if you have a stock, if you own a stock and its earnings are growing fast enough to offset the rise in interest rates, then you could still make a case that it's fairly valued. But if its earnings are not going to be growing faster than interest rates are rising, then you have to rethink your strategy.
Well, I think exactly. And that's what we've seen in the market in so far this year is investors are anticipating a rise in interest rates. And so if you dissect the market by growth stocks versus value stocks, which are less sensitive to interest rate rises, have been outperforming. And so it's the growth area of the market that's weak.
Chris and Peter, thanks very much for joining me this afternoon.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Peter Sorrentino, Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager with Huntington Funds, and Financial Advisor Chris DeSimeo.